Buenas tardes, good afternoon. The 13th meeting of the 10th session of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues is called to order. Distinguished members of the forum, distinguished observers and friends, ladies and gentlemen. At this afternoon meeting, we shall conclude our discussion of Agenda Item 8, Future Work of the Permanent Forum, including issues of the Economic and Social Council and emerging issues. We will begin by hearing the introductions of two special rapporteurs' studies. I first give the floor to Ms. Eva Biodet, member of the Permanent Forum, to introduce the special rapporteur study on forced labor and indigenous peoples as contained in document EC19-2011-CRP4. You have the floor, Ms. Biodet.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. During its ninth session in 2010, the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues requested that Mrs. Eliza Kanki to prepare a report on forced labor and indigenous peoples to be presented at the 10th session. Unfortunately, Mrs. Eliza Kanki was not able to attend this year's session of the Permanent Forum. Therefore, I will make a brief presentation of her report. There are many numbers and different numbers on the victims of this modern day slavery. What they all have in common is that they talk about millions of people. The ILO has estimated that there are at least 12 million people who are victims of forced labor in the world. Today, people still live in slavery-like conditions and are treated as commodities and exploited for economic profits in labor, for sexual purposes, in crime, in begging, in violent conflicts. Some researchers estimate that there are up to 27 million people living in slavery-like conditions today, perhaps more than ever. Trafficking in human beings, whether it's crossing borders or happening within national territories, in rural areas or urban regions, is a growing challenge in all our countries. Persons in migration who are in an irregular situation and not familiar with the language nor the circumstances are particularly at risk of being exploited in the most serious ways. Women and children are very vulnerable to this phenomenon, and in addition to being exploited for labor, often become victims of sexual abuse and violence. Forced labor takes place in all our regions throughout the world and is often linked to long-standing patterns of discrimination. Historically, indigenous peoples have suffered enormously from slavery and forced labor, and many still continue to do so today. Due to discrimination, marginalization, poverty, lack of livelihoods, and little information about their rights, indigenous peoples are particularly vulnerable to exploitation and sometimes end up even in forced labor, debt bondage, and trafficking of all forms. Men, women, and children are forced into labor in inhumane conditions. Victims of forced labor and human trafficking can be found in a number of sectors, ranging from agriculture, fisheries, construction work, domestic servitude, tourism and manufacturing. The ILO estimates that 20% of the people living in slavery-like conditions have been internationally trafficked for sexual exploitation, the vast majority of them being women and children. However, it is important to remember that we are discussing a clandestine criminal activity which is not likely to be identified by authorities, even when mechanisms for combating human trafficking, such as criminalization, national action plans, national coordinators, and national rapporteurs are set in place accordingly as recommended in international instruments. Additionally, the purposes of exploitation may vary and may be combined. Indigenous children are disproportionately affected by trafficking human beings and trafficking for forced labor. In Brazil, it has been reported that indigenous children are recruited to cut trees or to work in mines. In Peru, a high number of indigenous children are forced to work in the gold mining industry. In Madre de Dios, in Peru, 20% of the workers are between 11 and 18 years of age. Be it that the ILO 182 Convention on Child Labour has been enforced since 1999, child labour still flourishes in the world. Studies show clear correlation between low school enrolment and child labour. According to UNICEF, there are 150 million children working, the highest prevalence of child labour being in sub-Saharan Africa. According to the ILO, 115 million children are found in the worst forms of labour, labour that clearly is harmful to their health. Gender statistics imply a higher number of boys in visible child labour, whereas girls make more than 90% out of domestic child labour. For the future, the high numbers of youth unemployment with a growing indigenous youth population should be of significant concern, bearing in mind the risks of becoming victims of labour exploitation and trafficking. Children and youth migrating nationally or internationally are facing particular hazards. To illustrate this, let me tell you that in the last 2 years alone, 58,000 adolescent children, 34,000 of them being unaccompanied, were repatriated from the US to Mexico, and 9,000 of them further to their countries of origin. Many of these children were indigenous. While providing a brief global overview of the situation of indigenous peoples in forced labor, Mrs. Kanki's study focuses largely on the situation in Latin America. This study, as well as many other studies, show that forced labor is often related to the activities of the private sector, but that states too are involved in the practices of forced labor. The study recognizes that this has been the case with the sugar industry in Mexico. As has already been mentioned, indigenous peoples constitute a particularly vulnerable group also for forced labor. They face social exclusion and discrimination, and many times possess little or no awareness about their rights and the fact that many live in remote areas means that they are disproportionately affected by forced labor. The situation of indigenous peoples in the context of forced labor has been discussed in the Permanent Forum on previous occasions, as members of the forum conducted a mission to Paraguay and Bolivia in 2009 to investigate indigenous peoples in forced labor. The situation of indigenous peoples in forced labor in Bolivia was also brought to light by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which in 2008 reported that many indigenous Guarani people live in a state, quote, reminiscent of slavery, in extreme conditions, and are subjected to punishments, including lashings, end of quote. The study prepared by Mrs. Kanki examines, amongst other, the situation of indigenous domestic workers. Indigenous domestic workers are often working under slave-like conditions in areas far from their own homelands or territories. The victims do not get their protection or support they need, sometimes because there is a lack of adequate labor laws or lack of criminalization of forced labor, or perhaps most often because legislation and regulations are not implemented enough. The situation of domestic workers in Mexico is briefly outlined in the study. In some cases, girls and women who are subjected to this work are made infertile by their bosses, and more often become victims of sexual harassment as well as physical and psychological violence, just to illustrate an example of what usually happens. The ILO reports that in Latin America and the Caribbean, at least 2 million girls work as maids. These girls are at high risk of various kinds of exploitation, ranging from verbal and emotional mistreatment to sexual and physical violence. The ILO notes that girls working as domestic workers are often submitted to discriminatory and humiliating treatment and frequently work in subhuman conditions, such as sleeping on the floor and eating leftovers, and working 12 to 16-hour days a week, with no holidays or vacation, which renders it impossible for them to obtain an education. Even if during the last decade, perhaps the number of countries that have, for instance, criminalized trafficking in human beings has doubled, yet we see hardly no prosecutions and hardly no convictions for this crime. Indeed, lots remains to be done. Implementation is the key, and discrimination is one of the basic root causes that allow exploitation in forced labor and in trafficking to prevail. According to the ILO study, which is called The Costs of Coercion, more than $20 billion are lost or are gained by the perpetrators, but are lost by these people in forced labor. So there is a lot of money involved. It is of utmost importance that states, in collaboration with UN agencies and regional intergovernmental organizations who possess a lot of knowledge in these issues, increase their efforts to combat forced labor and human trafficking, and that they put in place adequate instruments to protect victims, paying particular attention to indigenous peoples and the restoration of victims' rights. Thank you, Mrs. Chair.
I thank Ms. Biadet for her introduction, and I now give the floor to Ms. Victoria Tauli Corpus to introduce the special rapporteur's study on the impact of the global crisis on indigenous peoples.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. This report has been long overdue. It was supposed to have been submitted earlier, and again, it now is in the final stage, but I would like to just walk you through some of the contents of the report. First, the report looked into the global and economic financial crisis, which hit the world in 2008 and still has lingering impacts on indigenous peoples. What this report wants to highlight, basically, is that this crisis is not just a fluke, but a result of systemic weaknesses in the global economic system. There is no doubt that this economic crisis has the most adverse impacts on indigenous peoples, not only in the United States where the crisis has started, but also in other parts of the world. In a report which was presented by Jacqueline Johnson Pata, the Executive Director of the National Congress of American Indians, she stated in a testimony which she presented before Congress that unemployment rate has soared between 50 to 90% among the tribal communities in the United States because of the crisis. Many communities were affected because of the layoffs done by gaming operations, but also because of the collapse of the construction business of which many Native Americans are involved. At that time, she requested that the stimulus package of the federal government to help ease the impacts of the crisis should also go to the Native Americans. 8 of the 10 poorest countries in the U.S. are on reservations, and the stimulus funds could go far in helping with projects on the ground. Since then, I saw data which showed that some Native Americans benefited from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, which included approximately $2.5 billion to create jobs and economic opportunity in Indian country. Aside from the impacts on Native Americans, the report also looked into what happened to indigenous peoples from Mexico and the rest of the Americas. many indigenous peoples who migrate temporarily or permanently to the U.S. had their remittances to their families drastically reduced because they were laid off from their work. Similarly, for indigenous peoples from Asia who come to the U.S. and other countries to work as domestic helpers, they also suffer the same fate. What I want to highlight in this introduction, though, is what has to be done in the light of this crisis, which is not really going away if the world proceeds with business as usual. A common conclusion reached by various reports is that the theory of self-correcting and efficient markets is debunked by this crisis. It is not just a result of a temporary malfunctioning or aberration of the economic growth model, but a clear failure on its own terms. Its promise of endless stable growth and increasing incomes for most people has not come about. Instead, we have witnessed gross inequities, volatility, and ecological degradation. The New Economics Foundation, a respected think tank based in the UK, said that these are not anomalies, but a natural and increasingly severe expression of the normal functioning of the system. Similar conclusions were reached by the report of the Stiglitz Commission, which says that the present crisis demonstrates failure at many levels of theory and philosophy of institutions, policies and practices, and less overtly of ethics and accountability. This report states, and I quote, "The current financial crisis, which began in the United States, then spread to Europe, has now become global. The rapid spread of the financial crisis from a small number of developed countries to engulf the global economy provides tangible evidence that international trade and financial system needs to be profoundly reformed to meet the needs and change conditions of the early 21st century. The crisis has exposed fundamental problems not only in national regulatory systems affecting finance, competition, and corporate governance, but also in the international institutions and arrangements created to ensure financial and economic stability. These institutions have proven unable to prevent the crisis and have been slow to design and implement adequate responses. Indeed, some policies recommended by these institutions have facilitated the spread of the crisis around the world. According to Miguel Discoto, the GA president, when he made a foreword to this report, he said that these crises are not the result of a failure or failures of the system. Rather, the system itself, its organization and principles, and its distorted and flawed institutional mechanisms is the cause of many of these failures. While there are claims that the world is overcoming this crisis, and indeed, now there is not much talk about this, evidences show that most countries, both developing and developed, are still undergoing economic decline, and economic recovery is far from being reached. For many indigenous peoples, they view this crisis as just one side of the coin. The other side is the global ecological crisis of biodiversity loss, resource depletion such as peak oil, and climate change. This situation the world faces now is clearly the direct result of the economic growth model, which promotes unfettered markets, export orientation, debt dependency, overconsumption, and overproduction. Development has exceeded the carrying capacity of the ecosystems in various geographic areas, whether measured by the footprint analysis or by the number of endangered species, degraded ecosystems and land, deforestation, or decrease in fish stocks. It is also clear that social inequalities are not being reduced with growth and globalization. After this economic and financial crisis, we are now witnessing a global food crisis, which is hitting many indigenous peoples in all parts of the world. There are massive land grabs taking place not only in Africa, but also in Asia, where richer countries are buying of lands to raise food for their people. The current food crisis in particular has been estimated as being responsible for pushing more than 150 million back into poverty, with serious consequences for health outcomes and nutritional status, making it more difficult to achieve the Millennium Development Goals. The report also looked at the increasing the food price index, such as the World Bank's Global Food Price Index, which shows that in March 2011, the food index remained 36% above its level a year earlier. Key staples that remain significantly higher last year include maize, which rose by 74%, the price of wheat, which rose by 69%, soybeans by 36%, and sugar by 21%. This all show that the crisis that we face is not at all ebbing, and clearly there is a need to revisit the economic and ecological crisis from the perspective of indigenous peoples to see how we are coping with this and for us to come up with more concrete proposals in terms of reforming or changing the ways development or economic growth are being pursued. Finally, this brings me to the recommendation that this particular situation has really to be dealt with and addressed in the forthcoming events that are going to happen soon, in particular the Rio Plus 20 and the World Conference of Indigenous Peoples. We have to come up with more bold proposals on how we should address these changes that are very much needed. For the Rio Plus 20 process, we heard last week that the themes will revolve around the green economy and around emerging issues. And I think this is the most opportune time for us to come up with our proposals on how to develop an economy that is not just green, but that is also sustainable, that is equitable, and that addresses the injustices against indigenous peoples. So with this, we think that the emerging issues also related to the food crisis as well as the water crisis should be brought into the center of the discussions of Rio Plus 20. So in conclusion, I would like to recommend to the Permanent Forum to do or to support the efforts of indigenous peoples to develop their own reports in relation to Rio Plus 20, which will include the reports of how they are coping with this crisis, but also how they are developing systems, economic systems, or green economies that are very much appropriate for their ecosystems as well as for their cultures. Thank you very much, Madam Chairperson.
I thank Ms. Tauli Corpus for her introduction. I now open the floor to the participants inscribed on the list of speakers to make their statements on agenda item 8. Before we begin with the list of speakers, I would like to remind speakers to observe the time limit of 5 minutes and to speak at a reasonable speed. If time allows, following our consideration of agenda item 8, I will give the floor to some organizations that were inscribed to speak under agenda item 4, human rights, but did not yet have the chance to take the floor. The first speaker on my list for item 8 this afternoon is Mrs. Michelle Klein-Solomon from the International Organization for Migration.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairperson, distinguished members of the Permanent Forum, delegates, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen. It is an honor and indeed a great pleasure to be here on behalf of the International Organization for Migration to speak before this, the 10th Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. It's in the context of increased dialogue and partnership with Indigenous communities that IOM joins this forum. We're pleased to reiterate our readiness to work with the international community, to enhance the level of participation and contribution of Indigenous peoples in addressing many global crises affecting them, including those related to climate change and environmental degradation. I listened with great interest to the two reports that were just offered, and several of my remarks will pick up on some of the specific themes that were identified by them. The nexus between migration and Indigenous peoples is unique. It's unique in the world. And this is because the especially close connection of the communities to their land, the migration of Indigenous peoples from their physical and cultural environment, whether forced or voluntary, often has a deep collective and cultural impact. In the migration process, Indigenous peoples are at risk of losing both tangible and intangible connections to their native lands, unique community life, and traditions that have been preserved and cherished for centuries. Traditional policies of integration and assimilation promoted in other contexts for regular migrants are problematic and potentially harmful in the case of Indigenous peoples. Because of their strong connection to the land and nature, Indigenous peoples and their traditional colonies are particularly vulnerable in the face of multiple effects of climate change, including diminishing land and associated rights. Environmental degradation, climate change, poverty, and lack of sustainable livelihoods can become very strong push factors for Indigenous peoples to consider migration as a means of survival and ensuring a better future for next generations. Typically, Indigenous peoples migrate to urban areas or abroad in search of employment, educational prospects and opportunities, improved access to health services and housing, increased political participation, social recognition, or visibility that they may lack in their native communities. They migrate as well as an adaptation response to climate change and environmental degradation. Indigenous peoples have acknowledged that migration often becomes their only means to ensure the survival of the traditional way of life in their territories through urban-rural remittances that were just referred to. While migration can be empowering for some Indigenous communities, for others, it brings risks of exploitation and abuse. Facing discrimination and poverty while seeking employment opportunities abroad or in urban areas, some Indigenous peoples are recruited by labor intermediaries who, through wage advances and other manipulations, induce them into artificial debt that they cannot repay. The situation is exacerbated in the case of Indigenous women who find themselves too often at the bottom of the occupational ladder in the labor market. Trafficking of Indigenous peoples, as we've just heard, is an increasing concern because of their particularly vulnerable social position. Regrettably, instances of trafficking of Indigenous women, girls, and boys are on the rise and being reported in more countries around the world. As was just mentioned in Azer, for example, Indigenous migrant women are at particular risks of the negative effects of urbanization and have special needs for support against physical and emotional harassment and to counter the risk of being lured into human trafficking networks. For its part, IOM pays special attention to the impacts of migration on Indigenous peoples, and I'll give you just two examples. The first, in Colombia, all of our projects incorporate a strategy for inclusion of an ethnic focus for Indigenous and Afro-Colombian communities. Indigenous communities in Cambodia are learning now how to plan and prepare to respond to natural disasters through an IOM project that supports the formation of village disaster management teams. In this context, we've undertaken research and work with relevant communities to map the nexus between Indigenous and climate change, to approach these issues in a systematic and holistic way that gives due regard and assistance to the needs of Indigenous peoples. Measures are needed to address, Madam Chairman, the particularities of Indigenous migration, including its underlying push factors. If and when Indigenous peoples choose to migrate, it's important to avoid the dilution of their customs and traditional ways of life by empowering Indigenous peoples against discrimination, encouraging education in native languages, training in traditional crafts and skills, and promoting a different but equal approach to Indigenous migrants within host societies. This requires very high levels of cooperation between the Indigenous communities and the host government and with other stakeholders. As so many of the speakers have underscored, preserving diversity in a globalizing world is a very difficult undertaking, and it can only be achieved through an inclusive process that gives voice to Indigenous peoples in the formulation of policies that affect them. We advocate in the International Organization for Migration for a closer dialogue and cooperation of all stakeholders in national, regional, and international levels on migration issues to ensure that the voice of all affected groups, including Indigenous, are heard and taken into due account. I thank you very much for the time and wish you great success with this year's Permanent Forum.
Thank you for your statement. I give the floor to Shelley Solis from the Pacific Indigenous Peoples Caucus. I give the floor to Jocelyn Chiang Thing from the Global Indigenous Youth Caucus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Naomi Lanoi, and I'll be speaking on behalf of Jocelyn, a young Maasai from Kenya. This is a closing statement of the Global Indigenous Youth Caucus at the 10th session of the Permanent Forum. As all the previous statements, this statement is drafted and endorsed in a collective manner. The Global Indigenous Youth Caucus gratefully appreciates all the assistance and support for our engagement and participation in this session of the forum. We were blessed to come together in solidarity to have our first preparatory meeting on May 15, 2011 in New York City. Youth contributed their threads of thoughts and wove their fabric that was supported and upheld by the attending senior Indigenous rights defenders. The preparatory meeting was successful in preparing the youth for their participation in the forum, and we wish to continue this for the years to come. We give special thanks to DOSIP for their commitment and continuous support to our work. As reiterated several times, we are firmly committed to cooperating with the Secretariat of the Forum and the UN agencies to carry on the work beyond the session of the forum. While we are highly privileged to sit in this room, most of the world's Indigenous youth have no access to such an opportunity. Therefore, it is our responsibility to reaffirm and call for your attention to the following issues. One, Indigenous peoples, especially youth, have the right to participate in decision-making processes, including this forum. We reaffirm that our Indigenous nations shall be the ones to be looked upon in this forum, not nationality defined by modern sovereign states. Delegates traveling to the forum shall be protected from being detained, kidnapped, and denied entry due to visa. A credentials, political interference, and other hidden agendas. Indigenous people's right to participation, assembly, and freedom of speech and travel shall not be infringed by any forces. We call for transparency, due process, and legitimacy to appeal for the Indigenous people's organizations that are denied access to the forum. Without providing these measures of accountability, the forum cannot live up to the expectation of Indigenous peoples. Two, unrecognized and underrepresented Indigenous peoples shall be given special attention. No Indigenous person shall be excluded from international human rights protection, even if they are not recognized as Indigenous people, either domestically or internationally. The need to include such populations under international and domestic Indigenous right protection in accordance with Article 3 of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Given that the Chittagong Hill Tracts region has still been a heavily militarized region due to the non-implementation of the CHT Accord, it is now a serious concern that the Indigenous youth human rights to participate through raising their voice for the implementation of their rights has been violated through means including arbitrary arrest and harassment. Delaying the implementation of the CHT Accord also created the unfairness of employment and education opportunity. We strongly call for the immediate implementation of the CHT Accord and recognition of the CHT Juma people as Indigenous people. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your statement. I give the floor to Mr. Alan Cairos from the Government of Brazil.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to refer to a previous mention to Brazil during the presentation of a report in this forum earlier this afternoon. The Brazilian government would be very thankful to receive any precise indication of the existence of indigenous or child forced work in our country. We are engaged in a very serious and difficult fight against those criminal phenomena, and they do not at all receive any approval or support from neither the Brazilian society nor the Brazilian government. Those are criminal activities that must be punished and suppressed from Brazil. In this sense, we would very much appreciate precise indications about where those phenomena would be occurring and involving which indigenous peoples in our country, because as you may know, we have a very large extension. It's a continental country, and there are too many different situations depending on the regional aspects. So we would very much appreciate, because the public ministry, the federal police, they do not have as yet, as far as we know, any precise indication of such problems in our country. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your intervention. I give the floor now to Josie Goy from the Indigenous Peoples of Australia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Indigenous Peoples Organisation of Australia is pleased to provide this intervention on forced labour and the global financial crisis. Forced labour is an issue that impacts on many Indigenous people around the globe. In Australia, Indigenous people have been and continue to be excluded from the Australian economy. The result is widespread intergenerational poverty. In Australia, this is a contentious political issue. Absolute poverty in Aboriginal communities is real, confronting, and unacceptable. Its history is embedded in the continuous theft and control of land and resources from the beginning of colonisation in 1788 through to today, where the government is now forcing Aboriginal people to lease back their land. Government is taking land in exchange for housing and basic services for businesses and government offices, with leases for terms ranging from 5, 40 and even 99 years. The roots of successive governments' actions lie in their unshakable belief that Aboriginal people are inadequate and incapable of managing their own affairs. We are depicted as fundamentally irresponsible, especially with handling money and protecting our children, and therefore many of us are in need of guidance, control, and intervention. From 1848 through to 1970s, under government segregation and assimilation policies, Indigenous peoples were forced to work for basic rations in menial tasks and conditions akin to slavery. Further welfare payments and wages were misappropriated by missionaries, pastoralists, and homeowners who had Indigenous people work for them. This misappropriation is known collectively as the stolen wages. An Australian Senate inquiry entitled Unfinished Business Indigenous Stolen Wages, in 2006 made a number of recommendations in relation to stolen wages, including the establishment of compensation schemes. To date, most recommendations from the Senate inquiry remain unimplemented. Since 1975, the government introduced the Community Development Employment Program, commonly known as CDP. Under the Northern Territory Intervention Emergency Response, CDP has been reformed and compels Indigenous people to work for private housing consortiums and shire councils with Aboriginal labour paid half as a welfare payment and half as a ration card. Article 21 of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples states that Indigenous peoples have the right, without discrimination, to the improvement of their economic and social conditions. In addition, 21.2 confers that states shall take effective measures and, where appropriate, special measures to ensure continuing improvement of economic and social conditions. Increasing Indigenous participation in Australian economy is a significant challenge that must be addressed. Indigenous peoples remain significantly disadvantaged. The benefits from possible economic opportunities derived from the Indigenous assets base have always been limited, but the global financial crisis has exacerbated and further compromised Indigenous peoples' opportunities to access potential benefits from their lands. In some instances, where traditional owners' groups have negotiated economic gain and forfeited their access to their traditional lands and native title rights, those economic those economic gains have become jeopardised as a result of global financial crisis. In many cases, where the extractive industries is adversely affected by economic instability, it is Indigenous jobs that are lost and land access agreements pushed aside. The Indigenous Peoples Organisations of Australia recommends that the Permanent Forum urge all states, include within the scope of the definition of forced labour and related responses, policies that compel Aboriginal people to be bound to exploitive labour programs that exchange labour for welfare payments or ration cards. We also urge all states to establish national compensation tribunals for stolen generations and wages of Indigenous peoples. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you for your statement. Esteban Pérez, del Parlamento Indígena de América, tiene la palabra.
Gracias, Presidenta. Buenas tardes. El impacto negativo que ha ocasionado la implementación de proyectos de desarrollo en territorios indígenas, generando la alteración de nuestros hábitats, el modo de vida tradicional, los graves desequilibrios en el ecosistema y el desplazamiento de nuestros pueblos, se debe a la falta de una política inclusiva de los estados en la que participen los pueblos indígenas. Es por ello que se hace necesaria la inclusión en este tema, de este tema en este foro, porque es un clamor de los pueblos la participación protagónica en las diferentes instancias de las organizaciones internacionales, regionales e internos, porque es la única vía que nos garantiza el derecho a la consulta previa e informada ante cualquier actividad susceptible de afectarle o sobre otros asuntos que son de suma importancia para nuestros pueblos. Tomando en cuenta que actualmente todavía hay países que no han adoptado el convenio 169 de la OIT ni la Declaración de las Naciones Unidas sobre los Pueblos Indígenas, desde Venezuela proponemos que se incluya en la agenda futura de este foro el tema de la participación protagónica de los pueblos indígenas. Esto basado en la experiencia que hay en Venezuela sobre el empoderamiento que han tenido en nuestro país nuestros pueblos indígenas gracias a ese reconocimiento histórico por parte del gobierno bolivariano encabezado por el comandante Hugo Chávez. En cuanto a los avances en este ámbito, rumbo a la suprema felicidad social y la consolidación del buen vivir, tal como se establece en las leyes de nuestra República, Presidenta. Es todo y muchas gracias.
Muchas gracias por su planteamiento. I give the floor to Ana Tambaeva, League of Caucasus Women Altinai, from South of Siberia. I give the floor to Ellen Gabriel, First Peoples Human Rights Coalition.
Greetings to all my relations. This is addressing the future item work for the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. Our elders teach us that our language is a gift from Sungoyat Ditsu, the Creator. It is unimaginable to think of self-determination to be fully realized without the perpetuation of indigenous languages. Our languages are living and as such should be used in our daily lives, not just on special occasions or to give a child a name. Oppression and colonization have eroded our use of our languages, which we need for our health and well-being, our systems of governance, and to guide us in the stewardship of our lands and resources. Nation building must simultaneously incorporate language and its revitalization to overcome the effects of colonization and assimilation. Our land is intricately linked to our identity. However, our identity is composed of many factors, not the least of which is our language. As one elder stated, it has taken over 100 years to bring our nations, lands, and our languages to the point of where it is in such a vulnerable state that it will take many years and generations to overcome. Every day we lose indigenous language speakers who carry with them our traditional knowledge. Therefore, we would like to emphasize the statement of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues in their report of the International Expert Group meeting on Indigenous Languages in 2008. Language revitalization must go deeper than collaboration with various UN agencies. Documenting and archiving is a necessity, but should not be relied on solely to preserve, perpetuate languages in critical states, in Article 44D. In our humble opinion, the majority of indigenous languages are in critical states, exemplified in the fact that in Canada, only 3 of the 52 languages are expected to survive to the end of this century. We would like to recommend the following to the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues for their future program of work. 1, a process of implementation of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People be undertaken especially for Articles 6, 8, 13, 14, 15, and 16. The full implementation by states on the recommendations of the UN Permanent Forum of Indigenous Issues report of the International Expert Group meeting on Indigenous Languages, and that special efforts and focus be directed towards grassroots community efforts and its indigenous language educators. That the issue of indigenous languages be incorporated in all programs of work of the Permanent Forum, and that efforts be made to harmonize the implementation of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples with the principles of the UNESCO Universal Declaration on Cultural Diversity and related conventions. And that the UN Permanent Forum of Indigenous Issues examine existing international research on indigenous languages in order to expeditiously support indigenous communities' efforts in language revitalization. Thank you very much. Nyakoa, Tonikawanike.
Thank you for your statement. I give the floor to Nikki Seneca from the Seneca Nations of Indians, North America.
Honorable Chair and esteemed members of the Permanent Forum, the Seneca Nation of Indians thanks you for the opportunity to take part in the 10th session of the Permanent Forum. This is the first session that a delegation from our council has attended, and we welcome the opportunity to join with many distinguished delegations of Indigenous peoples at the international level to affirm our rights as a sovereign Indigenous nation. Acting in our capacity as a self-determining people and as a sovereign nation, in the 18th century, the Seneca Nation signed a series of treaties with the United States that ensures our exclusive ownership and governance of our territories. In the Treaty of Canandaigua of 1794, the United States acknowledged the Seneca Nation's right to the free use and enjoyment of Seneca lands in exchange for the Seneca Nation's promise of peace and friendship with the United States. The Seneca Nation negotiated these treaties as a strong sovereign nation. When the Seneca Nation and the United States signed the treaties, both treaty partners understood they were entering the treaties on a nation-to-nation basis. Honorable Chair, members of the Permanent Forum, we testify that the United States has not respected or honored its historic treaties with the Seneca Nation. For instance, in the 1960s, the United States built the Kinzua Dam and flooded one-third of our Allegheny Territory, territory that was guaranteed to us under our treaties. It did so without our consent and in the face of our opposition, and for the benefit of non-Seneca communities. The United States dam construction activities forced the relocation of 600 people whose homes were where the dam reservoir now sits. 10,000 acres of our land, once rich in forests, wildlife, and crops, remain underwater. This was an egregious breach of our treaty rights, which was unfairly upheld by the United States Supreme Court. The continued violation of our treaties demonstrates that respect for treaty rights and states' obligation to respect and honor treaties should remain an integral part of the Permanent Forum's future work. Our culture, society, and economy are threatened by the failure of our treaty partner to live up to the legally binding promises it made to us under our treaties. We are here at the Permanent Forum to remind our treaty partner that might does not make right, and that the international law holds states accountable for observing their obligations. It is clear that Indigenous peoples need an impartial and fair dispute resolution mechanism that uses international law to address treaty violations. We request that the Permanent Forum recommend that the expert mechanism on the rights of Indigenous peoples act on the conclusions of the first and second United Nations seminar on treaties, agreements, and other constructive arrangements between states and Indigenous peoples to examine the international nature of Indigenous state treaties and provide recommendations for developing a mechanism at the international level for resolving conflicts arising from treaties. Respect for treaty rights entails respect for all the rights contained in the Declaration. In particular, Indigenous peoples' rights to self-determination, culture, lands, territories, and resources, and the right to development. The Seneca Nation has the capacity to develop a strong economy that would support and nurture the social and cultural well-being of our people. However, our treaty partner has often acted to prevent our right to economic development. The right to development is a key aspect of treaty rights. Article 37 should be read with Article 20, the right to engage freely in all economic activities, and Article 21, the right without discrimination to the improvement of economic and social conditions. It should be interpreted in conjunction with Article 32, Indigenous peoples' right to freely dispose of their natural wealth, which is also guaranteed by the ICCPR and the ICESCR, as well as the right to development contained in the Declaration on the Right to Development. The Seneca Nation requests that the Permanent Forum continue to support the development of the legal framework for the implementation of Article 37 of the Declaration, with a particular emphasis on the interaction between treaty rights and Indigenous peoples' right to development. When President Obama announced the United States' support for the Declaration in December 2010, he stated that what mattered most were actions to match the words of the Declaration, and that he hoped that we are seeing a turning point in the relationship between our nations. In addition to the recommendations above, the Seneca Nation respectfully requests that the Permanent Forum make the following recommendations. 1. Encourage the United States to move forward with the implementation of the Declaration so that its adoption does represent a turning point for the respect of the rights of indigenous peoples. 2. Urge the United States to honor and respect its treaty obligations with indigenous peoples, which includes respecting the right to economic and social development and the right to develop natural resources and to work with its treaty partners to implement the Declaration as equals on a nation-to-nation basis. 3. Recommend that states that have treaties with indigenous peoples commit to implementing the Declaration with their indigenous treaty partners as equals, using the treaties as a framework for the implementation. And 4. We join with the other distinguished delegates who have requested that the Permanent Forum continue its call for the third UN seminar on treaties, agreements, and other constructive arrangements to be held in 2012 with the support of the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. Thank you.
Thank you for your statement. I give the floor to Rafael Tangmawia, SO Reunification Organization.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for giving me the floor. On behalf of my organization and on my own behalf, I congratulate your election to the chair of this August forum. Also, I thank you for allowing me to present a statement to the 10 sessions of this permanent forum. In earlier sessions of the UNPFII, I had the privilege of highlighting who the Zou indigenous people are and how come their fundamental rights had been deprived of through the process of colonization of their ancestral land and territory by rulers of the British India in the form of successive invasion concluded in their final invasion of their so-called Jin Lusay Expedition, 1888 to 1890, affecting the territorial tripartite division of the Zhou, Jin Lusay country, and the people therein under three administrative heads, namely under Assam, Bengal, and Burma provincial administrative divisions. Wrongful territorial division of the Zhou country with the people under three administrative units was acknowledged to be wrong by the Jin Lusay Conference, 1892, Fort William, Calcutta, which was attended by heads of the civil and military rulers of the British India government, who had resolved to put the Zhou country together again under one administrative head. 118 years had passed since the Jin Lusay Conference was held. And for generation after generation, we are the people being trapped into a situation where the agony of being a people of same ancestry with common culture and same language, but to three different nationalities, namely Bangladeshis, Indians, and Myanmarese, has been a grim political reality till today. The aim of my organization is restoration of the fundamental rights of Zhou indigenous people, which has been deprived of by way of tripartite division, and that should be restituted by way of reunification under one administrative head, rectifying the past errors of territorial divisions, and thereafter to let the Zhou people also avail the fundamental freedom towards a peaceful process of self-determination, following Atlantic Charter and UN Charter. Nevertheless, my organization holds no grudge against the present administration of Myanmar, India, and Bangladesh for the invasion, subjugation, and territorial division of the Zhou Jin Lusay country. It has been Zhou's hope and prayer that the United Nations, being well body, would initiate steps to rectify the past errors and injustice done to the Zhou people in the spirit and conforming to Jin Lusay Conference Resolution 1892, and as well in accordance with the provision of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Notwithstanding, respected Chair, less known and unexplored Zhou country has been endowed by God with huge natural and mineral wealth, that some parts of the land which falls within the northeast region of the Indian state administration are expected to be rich in oil wells and natural gas reserve, as well as some parts of the land under Myanmar's administration. Aware of the untapped natural resources and potential of the river for hydro power generation, state administration of India has its attention focused on undertaking massive oil drilling operation and construction of dams under Indian state-owned project, as Kaptai Dam had been done in Chittagong Hill Tracts, while in Pakistan, now Bangladesh, resulted displacement of the Zhou inhabitants, regardless of the consideration of the Zhou indigenous people's right, as well as neglecting free, prior, and informed consent as enshrined under Article 32 of the UNDRIP. My organization fears that accelerated the so-called development project of the states within the territory of the indigenous people in considering Article 19 of the UNDRIP would be added to deplorable insult to their rights and economic interests. With this end in view, my organization desire and suggests that the future work of the Permanent Forum should recommend a suggestion that the UN body should initiate a campaign and urge to all the states supporting the adoption of the UNDRIP to correspondingly adopt the UNDRIP in their respective national and regional legislative bodies while suspending the existing respective project works not in conform with the UNDRIP, subject to amendment or modification of their respective country norms, which will surely be enhanced towards implementation of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your comment. I give the floor to Rafael Quispe Flores, Centro de Estudios Aplicados a los Derechos Económicos, Sociales y Culturales de Bolivia. I give the floor to María Sumire from the Parlamento Indígena de América, de Perú. I give the floor to Yupo Abe and Oki Kano from the Ainu Association from Japan.
Yara Gere Kamuhuchi. Watashi wa Nihon kara kimashita. Eigo ga hanasenai node, ima tsuiyaku ni onegai o shitai to omimasu. Watashi wa sekai no senju minzoku no kyoudai ni Nihon de okite irukoto wo otsutai o shitai to omimasu.
I'm going to speak on his behalf. We would like to let our indigenous brothers and sisters know what is going on in Japan right now. Japan has entered an uncharted territory for humanity. A major earthquake hit Japan. After the unimaginable destruction, there emerged a vicious demon that no indigenous mythology in the world has known. Its name is radiation. The humans that worship nuclear power built the myth of safety. It is safe. There will never be a leak. No earthquake will affect it. But all those myths were broken and the nuclear reactor faced a meltdown. Now we're looking powerlessly at the nuclear leak. every day an unimaginable amount of radiation is spread to contaminate our produce and seafood. Children in Fukushima go to school every day risking exposure to a high level of radiation. Radioactive material inhaled through air or food could destroy our biological foundation. Nuclear power might contribute to economic development, but it will not make people happy. Humans can make nuclear plants, but can't control them. Nuclear power sows the seeds of fear and uncertainty. The government that promotes nuclear power protects power companies, but not the citizens. Uranium ores are mined in the territories of indigenous peoples, and their wastes are dumped near indigenous peoples' residences. We would like our indigenous brothers and sisters to pay closer attention to the threat of nuclear power, and we sincerely hope that we will unite and take a step towards stopping all nuclear development. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your statement. We have now finished the speakers under item 8, and I will call on the speakers of item 4A and 4B that were not able to speak on the day we discuss this team. I give the floor to Mark Holden from the Youth Caucus of Australia.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. We acknowledge that the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is the minimum standard for protecting the rights of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander youth. Indigenous youth are more vulnerable to exploitation, deterioration of health, or violation of their rights to cultural identity, education, and civil rights. These breaches can affect young people and subsequent generations. We acknowledge the Australian Government's endorsement of the Declaration. We see the creation of the National Congress Australia's First Peoples as the initial step towards the implementation of the Declaration, as an essential mechanism in the development of self-determination for our people, a fundamental human right expressed in the Declaration. Currently, Indigenous youth in Australia are much more likely to be incarcerated than non-Indigenous youth, with the average age of first custody into Australia is 13 years or younger. Indigenous youth who enter the justice system increases the risk of recidivism and hinders the chances of our young people in attaining appropriate levels of education in order to attain further employment. Indigenous children in Australia are also more likely to be removed by child welfare services than non-Indigenous children. State departments delivering culturally insensitive child welfare services affect the social and emotional well-being of our youth, with removal contributing to the loss of cultural identity, a stark violation of the principles of Articles 5, 7, 8, 9, 11, and 12 of the Declaration. Further to this, Indigenous young people who grow up without family support has led to a disproportionate number of young Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples abusing drugs and alcohol, often leading to further problems such as homelessness, youth suicide, and serious mental illness. The true spirit of the Declaration its entirety should be implemented as a minimum standard, with the most effective means of doing so being corresponding legislation in the spirit of Article 38 of the Declaration. Should the Declaration be implemented, it will require a specific focus on policies and programs for Indigenous young people. These policies and programs must be implemented in cooperation with local bodies and through genuine consultation with those Indigenous young people with their free, prior, and informed consent. What is now required are the first steps to assess how the Declaration could be implemented to protect the rights of Indigenous peoples in order to ensure the protection of Indigenous youth and subsequent generations. In addition, the states, including Australia, must also establish the same means of implementing the Declaration within all tiers and arms of their governments, creating a uniform means of protection of Indigenous peoples' rights. We therefore recommend that the Permanent Forum urge states to 1. Implement the Declaration in the form of corresponding legislation, 2. compile and publish a report as to the proposed means of how the declaration can be implemented by the next permanent forum in 2012, and three, to develop strategies in liaison with the federal, state, and local governments to implement a uniform standard of protection for Indigenous peoples. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your statement. I give the floor to William Montour for a joint statement from Canada. I give the floor to Anthony De Barma for a joint statement. I give the floor to Kimura Makiko for a joint statement from Asia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On behalf of the Shimingaiku Center, Asia Indigenous Peoples Pact, Forest Peoples Program, Citizens Network for Biological Diversity in Okinawa, No Helipad Tatake Resident Society Okinawa, and Moped Sanctuary Network, I would like to make a brief statement regarding the situation of human rights violations of Ainu people and Okinawan people. Since the adoption of the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples by General Assembly in 2007, the government of Japan has recognized Ainu as an indigenous people and established the Council to Promote Ainu Policy at the end of 2009. We recognize a certain limited progress in Ainu policy since 2007 at domestic level. However, the cases which violate the indigenous people's rights of the Ainu and the Ryukyu Okinawan people continue to take place in Japan. We are deeply concerned about the reluctance of the Japanese government to fully implement the UN DRIP and to embrace its spiritual, legal, and political implications. First, regarding the Ainu people, the city government of Mombatu, a municipality in Hokkaido, traditional Ainu territory, authorized a plan to build an industrial waste dumping site near the Mombatu River on February 26, 2010. The Mombatu River is one of the most important places for coexistence between the Ainu culture and the natural environment, and an important site for salmon swimming in the area. Prior to the authorization, the local Ainu community in Mombatu working in collaboration with local Japanese groups supporting environmental conservation demanded that the city government respect the UN DRIP and review the plan for the indigenous people's perspective. Unfortunately, the city government has not given any consideration to the Ainu rights, and the construction work has been already started. And the local Ainu people have sent application to the Prefectural Pollution Examination Commission to look into the matter. Secondly, regarding the Okinawan people, the government of Japan has not recognized Okinawa people as an indigenous people. As a result, the heavy presence of the U.S. military bases in Okinawa remains as a form of discrimination against the people of Okinawa. At present, two new military bases construction plans are being carried out under the agreement between the governments of Japan and the U.S., despite the long-time opposition from local indigenous peoples' communities. In response to their protest, the Okinawan Defense Bureau, the local agency of the government of Japan, has filed a strategic lawsuit against public participation against local indigenous community members. The reluctance of the Japanese government to implement the UN DRIP at the local level violates Ainu and Okinawan rights to participate in the decision-making process. The authorization of the construction of the industrial waste dumping site and the construction of military bases seriously violates the indigenous people's rights to free, prior, informed consent. Madam Chair, We would like to recommend the following. Number one, we recommend the government of Japan shall establish national and local systems in conjunction with indigenous peoples to obtain their free and informed consent prior to the approval of any project affecting their lands or territories and other resources in accordance with the UN DRIP. Secondly, we recommend that the city government of Mangbetu should respect free prior informed consent of the local Ainu community concerned and to reconsider the authorization of the industrial waste dumping site. Thirdly, we recommend that the government of Japan and the U.S. immediately stop the construction of the military bases in Hanoko and Aura Bay, as well as helipads in the Takeya, and review the plans. We request the Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights and fundamental freedoms of indigenous people should use his good office to directly intervene in the government of Japan regarding the construction of the industrial waste dumping site in Mangbetu City, Hokkaido Prefecture, and the construction of military bases in Hanoko and Aura Bay and helipads in Take, Okinawa. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your statement. I give the floor to Edward Porcua from the International Work Group for Indigenous Affairs. Give the floor to Dea Thiel, Aboriginal Medical Service, Western Sydney, Australia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before I begin, I would like to pay my respects to the traditional owners of this land where we are meeting, their elders past and present, and I would also like to acknowledge all my brothers and sisters attending this 10th session of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. No government tells the truth all the time, and the state of Australia is no exception. The life expectancy disparity between Aboriginal peoples and other Australians is an issue that has resulted in much international criticism of Australia. Until about 2005, Australia was reasonably honest about Aboriginal mortality estimates, which showed that the data was unreliable for most jurisdictions except the Northern Territory, and that the Aboriginal life expectancy was about 17 to 20 years less than that of non-Aboriginal Australians. Nothing much has changed about the reliability of Aboriginal mortality data in most parts of Australia, and it is widely acknowledged amongst most academics and governments involved in formal research in this area. However, the government advisers and statisticians have changed the way that Aboriginal mortality is estimated and have used compromised and flawed data. The miraculous result is that Aboriginal peoples are living substantially longer and our life expectancy gap has halved in approximately 3 years. One Australian epidemiologist has predicted that if the miracle continues, Aboriginal peoples will be immortal within 20 years. The reality is that no politician can say that life expectancy has improved. You cannot compare previous figures with new figures in the new methodology, even if the Australian Bureau of Statistics say that. But doing just that has served political interests. The state of Australia tells the international community that it strongly supports Aboriginal self-determination in health. It isn't telling the truth about that either. The true story is that the state of Australia, whilst acknowledging the importance of Aboriginal community-controlled health services, has diverted most federal expenditure to private for-profit general practice health services to close the gap in Aboriginal life expectancy. Over 70% of private doctors and general community health providers do not see a single Aboriginal patient, have had negligible cultural safety training, deliver primary medical care, not comprehensive primary health care, and are profit-making enterprises. Yet federal government has diverted a substantial proportion of an $805 million close-the-gap funding allocation to these services. While Aboriginal organisations are micromanaged by the government and have to submit to onerous funding conditions, private services still have embarrassingly trivial requirements to fulfil in order to acquit the large amounts of money they receive per Aboriginal patient. Meanwhile, despite flaunted increases in ACCHS's funding, these have only been at the same rate as health system funding increases overall from the Australian government, In other words, decades of funding gaps for ACCHSs are still gaping. In fact, as a share of all Aboriginal health-related funding, the proportion directed towards the ACCHSs has been declining since 2001-2002. The state of Australia has been publicly accused in the media by Aboriginal peoples of having a silent policy to destroy Aboriginal self-determination. It has not issued a denial. The defunding of numerous Aboriginal organisations continues. One example is the Karawara Aboriginal Women's Refuge, based in Western Sydney and offering domestic violence services to our women. The day-to-day interference by bureaucrats eventuated in the ultimate defunding of Karawara, which offers vital, culturally appropriate service in Western Sydney to our Aboriginal women and children who are escaping domestic violence. Self-determination is a basic human right, and without it, the United Nations would not exist. Recommendations. The above Indigenous Peoples Organisations of Australia recommend that the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, in the spirit of meaningful and effective partnership with Aboriginal peoples, develop a framework to fully implement the Declaration, including past legislation, to ensure that the provisions of the Declaration are legally binding pursuant to Article 46 of the Declaration. Otherwise, it is likely that the Declaration will be largely irrelevant in practical terms for Aboriginal communities at the coalface. We also request member states as signatories provide evidence as to how Aboriginal peoples have a governing role in all nationally aggregated data collections pertaining to their health to ensure the ownership, control and access of those data sets are protected by the principles of self-determination as highlighted in Article 3 of the Declaration and also by culturally appropriate Aboriginal standards. Finally, we urge member states to disaggregate expenditure data from member states to reflect the proportions directed to Aboriginal self-determining or representative bodies as appropriate indicators for Indigenous peoples. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your statement. I give the floor to Ronald Waromi, West Papua Indigenous Association. I give the floor to Ratana Gra Jansgri Kitisak from Indigenous Peoples Foundation for Education and Environment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to speak on the agenda item 4A. Madam Chair, a member of the Permanent Forum, Indigenous Brothers and Sisters, State delegations, ladies and gentlemen, the indigenous peoples of Thailand are commonly referred to as Hieu tribe or Chau Khao in Thai. Sometimes as ethnic minorities, there are 10 ethnic groups that are officially recognized as Hieu tribe people who live in the north and west of the country. The official term Chau Khao has been used since the late 1950s. It was used to refer to the non-Thai minority groups and generally meant to distinguish them from the civilized. The negative stereotyping of the Hieu tribes as forest destroyers, opium cultivators, and communist sympathizers was instituted in Thai society through the national education curriculum from primary to university level. As a response to these negative connotations of the official designation Chau Khao, indigenous organizations and indigenous rights advocacy groups began to promote the term Chon Pa Puen Mueang as a translation of indigenous peoples over a decade ago. This was our way of expressing our rights to self-identification. However, the government of Thailand has rejected the application of the term indigenous peoples and stated that these groups are as much Thai as the other Thai citizens and are able to enjoy the fundamental rights of citizens and are protected by the laws of the kingdom. However, until today, the indigenous people of Thailand continue to suffer from the same historical stereotyping and discrimination like other indigenous peoples elsewhere in the world. Madam Chairperson, Thailand has ratified and adopted several international human rights and environmental instruments. Thailand also voted in favor of the adoption of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples by the UN General Assembly These international legal commitments oblige the Thai government to recognize, respect, and protect the rights of indigenous peoples through national laws, policies, and programs. However, for the indigenous people of Thailand, the reality on the ground has hardly changed. The historical and institutionalized discrimination against the indigenous people of Thailand have shaped the policies, laws, and programs developed by the Thai government in relation to the indigenous peoples. Thus, there are no laws recognizing and protecting indigenous peoples' rights. The recent constitution passed in 2007 does not explicitly recognize indigenous peoples and their distinct identity. Indigenous people in Thailand are confronted with various problems, such as lack of citizenship, lack of land rights, rights over their forests and natural resources continue to be denied. The practice of traditional livelihood systems, such as shifting cultivations, has been criminalized. All this serve as threats to the livelihood and food security, cultural survival, and their continued existence as distinct peoples. All of these are in a violation of the UN drift. To address these problems, we ask the Permanent Forum to request the Thai government to first review and amend laws and regulations related to forests and lands with the full and effective participation of indigenous leaders and communities, such as the National Park Act, the National Forest Reserve Act, the Wildlife Conservation and Protection Act, and others that are related to the management of natural resources, to fully respect and recognize the collective rights of communities. Second, respect, protect, and promote the traditional occupations and livelihood system and practices of indigenous peoples, such as shifting cultivation, forest gathering, and hunting, in accordance with the Article 26 of the UN DRIP, and ensure their livelihood security. We also invite the Permanent Forum members and the special reporter to visit Thailand and jointly organize a workshop with the concerned agencies to discuss and find common solutions to the issues faced by indigenous people. Thank you, Madam Chairperson.
Thank you for your statement. I give the floor to Roberto Barrientos from AIM West. I give the floor to Lise Bastien, Conseil en Education de Premier Nación. I give the floor to Tupac Enrique, Tonatierra. I give the floor to Sunuwar Dev Kumar, International Group for Indigenous Affairs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Dev Kumar Sunuwar. Even though my name has been registered under IGWA, I'm speaking on behalf of Nepalese Indigenous Peoples. I'm speaking on agenda number 4A. First of all, we, the Indigenous Peoples representative, would like to thank you for giving us this opportunity on behalf of Nepalese Indigenous Peoples. We would like to express the concern on the denial of minimum human rights of Nepalese Indigenous Peoples, their access to participation in administration, development, decision-making process of the state building, and their recognition of identity. Every one of you are well aware that for the last 3 years, Nepal is in the process of writing a new constitution through Constituent Assembly. But the Nepalese indigenous peoples are still fighting for their meaningful participation in it and inclusion of their rights in the constitution. It is the fact that indigenous peoples are the main victims of so-called development, globalization, and militarization in the name of democracy and development. Currently, the government of Nepal has deployed security forces in various eastern parts in the name of security, which has suppressed the indigenous people's movement. Similarly, by declaring the energy emergency, the government has introduced a bill called Energy Crisis Bill, which has deprived indigenous peoples from their historical lands and natural resources, so as to raise their voices against those projects initiated without free, prior, and informed consent in their areas. Distinguished Madam Chair, the government has already ratified the ILO Convention 169 and is a signatory of UNDRIP, but the government of Nepal seems needless in their effective implementations. The government has neither ensured the participation of indigenous peoples in the National Human Rights Commissions and in the decision-making level of RAID program. Therefore, indigenous peoples are continuously facing the denial of their basic human rights, recognition of their genetic resources, traditional knowledge, and access to benefit sharing. We believe that it is important to recognize indigenous peoples' right to self-development, right to self-governance, and the right to self-determination for their overall development. Therefore, we would like to draw your attention and make following recommendation, Madam Chair. One, every state should follow the indigenous people's rights-based approach in the development, recognizing their collective rights, and therefore urge all the governments to enact legislation recognizing the rights of indigenous peoples in the lands, territories, and natural resources. Two, we urge all the government to ensure the meaningful participation of indigenous peoples in every decision-making level, and ensure that they are fully informed, consulted, and sought the consent in regards to the policies, plans, programs, and projects in the indigenous peoples' lands and territories. Three, we urge all the governments to ensure the indigenous peoples' right to education in mother tongues. Four, urge all the governments to ensure and implement the APIC in the process of every kind of projects that are undertaken in the indigenous peoples' areas. Regarding the implementation of APIC in the land, territory, and resources of indigenous peoples, we recommend international finance institutions to include APIC in their policy formulations and forest policies and programs, and the global policies on RAID. These policy formulations should be guided by the UNDRIP, and we also recommend UN to monitor the implementation of these at the national and regional level. To conclude, we strongly urge to mainstream indigenous peoples' issues and recognize indigenous peoples' rights within the UN system and the state policies. Similarly, we also urge all the international communities and the states to respect the rights of indigenous peoples as a conflict resolution measures and for the sustainable development. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your statement. I give the floor to Q. Mujendo Matuna from the Pastoral Women Alliance to Break Cultural Chains from Uganda. I give the floor to Morris Shanakapu from the Southern Chiefs Organization of North America. I give the floor to Narla Kunot Monks from Amnesty International Australia. I give the floor to Trang Lam from the Global Indigenous Youth Caucus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Global Indigenous Youth Caucus acknowledges that the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, the Declaration, is accumulation of the many views of and setting the minimum standard of the right of indigenous people. The declaration makes specific mention in Article 22 as to attention that must be paid to indigenous youth and its implementation. As stated, it must be ensured that indigenous youth enjoy the full protections and guarantee against all form of violence and discrimination in exercising their human rights. This is pertinent to us as we have the responsibility of protecting and passing on traditional knowledge and cultural heritage to future generations. The Global Indigenous Youth Caucus recommend the following. One, we recommend the Permanent Forum to our state that previously abstained from voting on the adoption of the declaration to reconsider their position. These include Russian Federation, Kenya, Bangladesh, and many more. Two, we recommend the Permanent Forum to urge member state to consider Article 38 of the Declaration in full consultation and cooperation with Indigenous youth throughout state legislative drafting processes. Three, we recommend that state and UN agency provide support and mechanism for Indigenous people and their organization to demonstrate how they have implemented the declaration for themselves. These examples would form the base for a global best practice guide on the implementation of the declaration from an Indigenous youth perspective. Four, we request the Interagency Support Group on Indigenous People Issues assist and nominate an appropriate United Nations agency to compile a database and a case study showing the progress of members' nation and organization regarding Indigenous youth rights in the implementation of the declaration. Case study can then be used as means of creating model framework for how the declaration can be implemented in their nation state wishing to adopt national legislation. Five, furthermore, according to the forum recommendation made in its first session, paragraph 31A, a report was requested on the policy guideline and programs of the United Nations agency to be prepared with regard to the way in which they address the specific needs of Indigenous children. We request such a report to be prepared immediately with the extension of how the UN agency are implementing the declaration with regard to Indigenous youth and children. Six, Article 41 of the declaration speculate that UN organs and specialized agency contribute to its full realization through financial cooperation and technical assistance. Specifically, we recommend that Indigenous youth are given this support to provide input within meeting and reporting involving UNICEF International Guideline on Sexuality Education, as well as UNICEF's Strategic Framework on Indigenous Youth and HIV. Seven, we recommend to the Permanent Forum to urge UN agency, treaty bodies, member state, and the Special Rapporteur to create and support of reporting mechanism for human rights violation of Indigenous youth, such as international tribunal, expert working groups, and additional resources to the Special Rapporteur. Eight, we recommend the Secretary of the Forum and UN agencies, such as UNICEF, UNDP, and UN programs on youth, cooperate closely with the Global Indigenous Youth Caucus to conduct a regional and international training program, building the capacity of Indigenous youth and defenders of how to respond effectively to current and emerging human rights challenges. Training program should also aim to increase skills and knowledge of UN mechanism and how more effectively lobbying and strategy creating for advocacy on how to implement the declarations on national and international level. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your statement. I give the floor to Legborsi Piagbara, Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People of Africa. I give the floor to Nora Erakat from Badil Resource Center for Palestinian Residency and Refugee Rights from Central Africa. I give the floor to Sana Imbari from the Negev Coexistence Forum for Civil Equality.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Sana Imbari, and I will speak on behalf of Negev Coexistence Forum for Civil Equality. I wish to draw your attention to State of Israel's efforts to displace the indigenous Bedouin from their ancestral land. Since the creation of the state in 1948, Bedouins have lived as internally displaced citizens within Israel. Today, nearly 80,000 indigenous Bedouin live in so-called unrecognized villages. which are characterized by a lack of basic services. They are denied running water, electricity, telephone lines, paved road, schools, medical services, and other public institutions. Further, the Bedouin are not secure in their own homes. All building in these villages, about 50,000 structures, are considered illegal by the government, even though it is impossible for the Bedouin to apply for building permits. Thus, homes can be demolished by the government at any moment, increasing poverty levels and inflicting great hardship on the most vulnerable, who are the women and children. In the last 12 months alone, the unrecognized village of El Aragib has been demolished for 21 times, leaving 300 residents exposed to the hot days and bitterly cold desert nights. The recent spike in the number of homes lost in this year seemed to be in line with the government's policy decision early last year to triple the demolition rate. As a Bedouin myself, I am compelled to remind the forum about these challenges facing the unrecognized villages and the seriousness of the state's action against its own people. The Arab Bedouin face the harshest consequences of discrimination through law as well as policy and practice. I draw your attention in particular to a new governmental plan to deal with the Bedouin. The plan resulting from the Prava Commission established to implement the recommendation of a previous commission is yet to be publicly released. However, portions of the leaked document reveal that the government will recognize less than a third of the area claimed by the Bedouin under the Israeli legal system to be recognized as their traditional land. Additionally, thousands of Bedouin will be displaced with their villages or transferred to new locations. The implementation of this Prava Commission will have a serious determinant impact on the Bedouin population in southern Israel. It has become clear to us that the government is moving to disinherit the Bedouin from their ancestral land. Thank you for turning your attention to these issues.
Thank you for your statement. I give the floor to Kumar Jonjon Tamang from Nepal Tamang Gedung. I give the floor to Maurice Job from Kuru Development. We have just listened to the last speaker on my list. Therefore, I intend to adjourn this meeting. I would like to thank Ms. Biadette and Ms. Tauli Corpus for introducing the teams. And I would also like to thank the speakers. I will give the floor to the Secretariat for announcements.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. There will be a meeting between states and the Permanent Forum members tomorrow from 9 to 10 in the morning in this conference room 1. That's it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. In accordance with our program of work, tomorrow we shall start our consideration of Agenda Item 9, Draft Agenda for the 11th Session of the Permanent Forum, 11 a.m. in this, at 11 in the same room, at 10 in the same conference room. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you, everybody.